Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 527, Side 1. The broadcast is titled Death Trap Part 2. It's a follow-up to For the Record program number 471. It's being recorded on September 18th of the year 2005. Last week, we recorded an interview with Ed Haslam, the brilliant author of the consummately important Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus. And specifically, Ed, not only a native of and longtime resident of the city of New Orleans, provided us with some first-hand insight into what exactly led to the catastrophe in New Orleans. We did not commemorate September 11th per se. In a sense, I think it was appropriate to have Ed on and to talk about what actually produced the devastation in New Orleans. There's a whole lot of hocus-pocus on the internet now. Again, the same kinds of lint heads who were talking about a controlled demolition of the World Trade Center or, you know, cruise missile hit the Pentagon, et cetera, are talking about, well, the dikes were dynamited, et cetera, et cetera. It was something else. There certainly was a human factor in what happened, whether it was incompetence or something else will never be determined precisely. But Ed had some very concrete and hands-on insights into what happened. That's not only is he familiar with New Orleans, but that particular area he's very familiar with, having been a competitive sailor and sailed in Lake Pontchartrain for many, many years. We did not, however, because of that, commemorate September 11th or observe the anniversary. We're going to do that this week, a week late, and we're going to specifically be taking a look at one of the major outgrowths of September 11th, namely the Iraqi misadventure. And we're going to take a look at one of the most terrifying and grave, and I mean that literally, implications of that, namely the fact that the much ballyhooed weapons of mass destruction, never actually found concretely, but the weapons of mass destruction capabilities, which were enormous, both nuclear and chemical and biological, have not, to say the least, been secured. On the contrary, there is every indication that the effect of the U.S. invasion with regard to the weapons of mass destruction capability that Saddam's Iraq had was rather like hitting mercury with a hammer. And that is most, most disturbing. It is my feeling, as I've indicated many times, that the U.S. fell into a trap in Iraq, and that the end result of that, it has already been enormously destructive to the United States, both economically and diplomatically, not to mention the loss of life among American service personnel, far greater than has been officially reported, according to a number of sources, and of course the exponentially greater loss of life among the Iraqis. But I think it is altogether possible that the upshot of what took place in Iraq, which was a most inappropriate response to September 11th, the upshot of that is going to be the destruction of the United States. I have spoken about the underground Reich so many times and about my hypothesis that the Muslim peoples of the Earth Island, the Arabic peoples in particular, are being used as proxy warriors by the underground Reich against the United States. It should be added that one of the greatest weapons being used against the United States at this point is a martial arts-like, jujitsu-like application of our own stupidity and immaturity, and that should not be as George Bush would have put it, that should not be misunderestimated. But there are some very, very, very serious things to contemplate in conjunction with Iraq and the future, and we are going to be taking a look now at how the United States, as I've said in the past, has gotten itself into that situation where it is between Iraq and a hard place, and a very, very, very hard place it is. One point before we launch into the main body of the texts that I'm going to include in this broadcast, the contemporary Nazi movement does not publish overt manifestos like Hitler's Mein Kampf. Rather, the blueprints are much more oblique. And two books, which basically are functioning like Mein Kampf for the contemporary Nazi movement, are the two novels published by National Vanguard Books, The Turner Diaries, authored by Andrew MacDonald, real name William Pierce, who foreshadowed the September 11th attacks in many ways in a 1998 shortwave broadcast, and another book called Serpent's Walk, authored by someone who writes under the name of Calver Hall. And both of those books are quite similar. They involve the United States being devastated by a series of terrorist incidents using weapons of mass destruction. When the society begins to disintegrate as a result of the economic and physical damage done to the country, martial law is declared, and in the context of that declaration, the Underground Reich takes over. So keep that in mind, and keep in mind the fact that there are domestic terrorist elements which would do such things, and that they appear to be hooked up to a certain extent at least with many of the Islamo-fascists associated with the Muslim Brotherhood, Al-Qaeda, and the Al-Taqwa milieu about which I've spoken so often. So keep in mind the manifestos of the contemporary Nazi movement. Both foresee the destruction of the United States as a prerequisite to the taking over of the world by this Underground Reich, then going overground. Both involve the destruction of the United States through a series of terrorist incidents using weapons of mass destruction, after which martial law is declared, and the Underground Reich comes overground and takes over. Bear in mind, too, that the climactic episode in the Turner Diaries, the blueprint for Timothy McVeigh and company, as well as for the Nazi terror group The Order, is a low-level suicide aerial attack on the Pentagon. Of course, you know, I'm just a conspiracy theorist, and that's just a novel. Silly, huh? Low-level suicide aerial attack against the Pentagon? Nothing like that could ever happen, could it? Of course not. We're going to begin by taking a look at a very eloquent column by Robert Scheer, the syndicated columnist who operates out of the Los Angeles Times, or uses that as a base. This was syndicated to the San Francisco Chronicle, which published it on Wednesday, August 31st of the year 2005, under the title, Iraq's Fig Leaf Constitution. One of the many grotesque ironies growing out of the Iraqi misadventure is the fact that incalculable damage has been done to the United States. Incalculable wealth, both fiscal and diplomatic, has been expended. There's been tremendous loss of life. And the upshot of it, basically, has been to install an Islamic fundamentalist government. Compared to what is taking place, the Iraq War makes the Vietnam War look like the breakthrough at Falaise, for those who are familiar with the history of World War II. It is a surreal state of affairs. And as I noted in, among other broadcasts, For the Record program 412, the engineer intends to wreck the train. This isn't, quote, U.S. imperialism, unquote, although some of the powerful corporate interests that have profited are certainly doing so. This ain't how you do empire, folks. This is how you do disintegration and annihilation. And I'll toss the gauntlet down to any member of the audience to cite a head of state who has slashed revenues while waging war. You can't do that, not unless, as an engineer, you intend to wreck the train. Robert Scheer, San Francisco Chronicle, August 31st, 2005, Iraq's Fig Leaf Constitution. It reads as follows. Who lost Iraq? Someday, as a fragmented Iraq spirals further into religious madness, terrorism, and civil war, there will be a bipartisan inquiry into this blundering intrusion into another people's history. The crucial question will be why a, quote, preemptive, unquote, American invasion, which has led to the deaths of nearly 2,000 Americans, roughly 10 times as many Iraqis, the expenditure of about $200 billion and incalculable damage to the United States' global reputation has had exactly the opposite effect predicted by its neoconservative sponsors. No amount of crowing over a fig leaf Iraqi constitution by President Bush can hide the fact that the hand of the region's autocrats, theocrats, and terrorists is stronger than ever. Quote, the U.S. has to recognize that it overthrew Saddam Hussein to replace him with a pro-Iranian state, unquote, said regional expert Peter W. Galbraith, the former U.S. ambassador to Croatia and an advisor to the Iraqi Kurds. And he could have added a pro-Iranian state that will be repressive and unstable. Think this is an exaggeration? Consider that arguably the most powerful Shiite political party and militia in today's Iraq, the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, and its affiliated paramilitary force, the Badr Brigade, was not only based in Iran, but was set up by Washington's old arch foe, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini. It also fought on the side of Iran in the Iran-Iraq War and was recognized by Tehran as the government in exile of Iraq. Parenthetically, as we discussed in For the Record 352, among other shows, the Ayatollah Khomeini's exile in France was financed by François Genoux, who, although he died in 1996, is an individual whose name looms most large over the events in and around September 11th. Continuing with Robert Scheer's accounting of the Iranian influence in contemporary Iraq, or that former exile Ahmed Shalabi is now one of Iraq's deputy prime ministers. The consummate political operator managed to maintain ties to Iran while gaining the devoted support of Donald Rumsfeld's Pentagon, charming and manipulating Beltway policymakers and leading U.S. journalists into believing that Iraq was armed with weapons of mass destruction. Chalabi is thrilled with the draft constitution, which, if passed, will probably exponentially increase tension and violence between Sunnis and Shiites. Quote, "It is an excellent document," said Chalabi, who has been accused by U.S. intelligence of being a spy for Iran, where he keeps a vacation home. What an absurd outcome for a war designed to create a compliant, unified, and stable client state that would be pro-American, laissez-faire capitalist, and unallied with a hated Iran. Of course, Bush tells us again, this is, quote, progress, unquote, and, quote, an inspiration, unquote. Yet his relentless spinning of manure into silk has worn thin on the American public and has sent his approval ratings tumbling. Even supporters of the war are starting to realize that rather than strengthening the United States' position in the world, the invasion and occupation have led to abject humiliation. From the Abu Ghraib scandal to the guerrilla insurgency exposing the limits of military power, to an election in which our guy, Iyad al-Alawi, was defeated by radicals and religious extremists. In a new low, the U.S. president felt obliged to call and plead with the head of the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution, Abdulaziz Hakim, to make concessions to gain Sunni support. Even worse, he was summarily rebuffed. Nevertheless, Bush had no choice but to eat crow and like it. Quote, "This is a document of which the Iraqis and the rest of the world can be proud," he said Sunday through what must have been gritted teeth. After all, this document includes such democratic gems as, quote, "Islam is the official religion of the state and is a basic source of legislation," unquote, and again quoting from the Iraqi constitution, quote, "No law can be passed that contradicts the undisputed rules of Islam," unquote, as well as socialist-style pronouncements that work and a decent standard of living are a right guaranteed by the state. But the fact is, it could establish Khomeini's ghost as the patron saint of Iraq, and Bush would have little choice but to endorse it. Even many in his own party are rebelling. Quote, "I think our involvement there has destabilized the Middle East, and the longer we stay there, I think the further that destabilization will occur," unquote, said Nebraska Senator Chuck Hagel last week, one of a growing number of Republicans who get that, quote, "we should start figuring out how we get out of there," unquote. Not that our what-me-worry president is the least bit troubled by all this adverse blowback from the huge, unnecessary gamble he took in invading the heart of the Arab and Muslim worlds. Quote, "What is important is that the Iraqis are now addressing these issues through debate and discussion, not at the barrel of a gun," unquote, Bush said. Wrong again, George. It was the barrel of your gun that midwifed the new Iraq, which threatens to combine the instability of Lebanon with the religious fanaticism of Iran. And I would add parenthetically, augmenting what Robert Scheer said, anybody who thinks that the political resolution currently unfolding in Iraq is being done through debate and legislation and not the barrel of a gun, well, it just obviously has either been asleep or had their heads lodged securely in some place that they had no business being. I call listeners' attention to the many broadcasts in which I've discussed my working hypothesis about September 11th and related events. I also want to call people's attention to For the Record 502 called Curveball, which analyzes the basis, the alleged intelligence basis upon which the United States proceeded into the Iraq invasion. An Iraqi exile who basically had been groomed by the apparent Iranian spy Ahmed Chalabi, and whom the United States never interviewed, but who was basically held for them by German foreign intelligence, the BND, was the basis upon which the United States went in there. And again, I think that The guile involved there on the part of the BND, the successor organization to the Reinhard Gehlen spy outfit, was no greater than what would be required to set a pot of honey out in front of a marauding bear under the circumstances. One of the things that is so disturbing about the Iraq War, I don't think the full implications of that have really sunk in for most people, and I think those are very likely to be devastating. It's also most unfortunate that in the debate on Iraq, there's no effective and viable middle ground. It's either, well, you know, there were Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction and he was involved in September 11th, or else it's all hocus pocus. Well, there's no evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved in September 11th. But unfortunately, and despite what a number of observers have said, there was a relationship of sorts between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda. It's not that Saddam Hussein was sponsoring al-Qaeda. In fact, Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party was a secular Arabo-fascist government with a strong Stalinist influence, rather like Nasser in Egypt, only more repressive. But the fact of the matter is, even though it was a secular government and the Muslim Brotherhood, the parent organization of al-Qaeda, was opposed to the Ba'ath Party, in fact, they worked out something of a doomsday agreement. In certain respects, at least, this was not unlike the functional alliance that took place between the United States and Britain and the former Soviet Union in World War II, even though they were enemies and were enemies before the war and enemies afterward. During the war, they, at least to a certain extent, buried the hatchet in order to combine their efforts against Nazi Germany. A similar type of doomsday arrangement was worked out between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party, where if, in a worst-case scenario for Saddam, the United States knocked out Saddam Hussein, then Saddam Hussein would use al-Qaeda as something of a backup unit, and the knowledge, the information, the technical expertise about his weapons of mass destruction programs, which was considerable, would be communicated to al-Qaeda to be used against the United States. Again, al-Qaeda was to serve as sort of a doomsday backup unit for Saddam Hussein in a worst case for Saddam Hussein scenario that the United States would knock him out of the box. Well, of course, that took place. Much of the best intelligence about al-Qaeda, about the events in and around September 11th, has come from French experts. Certainly France could not be labeled as running dog of U.S. imperialism, blah, 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 the stuff we hear coming out of the so-called progressive sector. At the same time, the French have dealt in a profound and hands-on way for a long time with Islamic terrorism, and so they are not unfamiliar with its capabilities. Some of the very best experts on Islamic terrorism and Islamo-fascism have come out of France, and among those is Roland Jacquard, who wrote a very authoritative book called In the Name of Osama Bin Laden, published in softcover by the Duke University Press, copyright 2002. And it was Jacquard writing in the Name of Osama Bin Laden, who discussed the doomsday contingency plan that was worked out between al-Qaeda and the Ba'ath Party of Iraq. Quote, "It appears, however, that this version is only the publicly admissible one, the one that can pass political muster." Again, that's the allegation that there was no connection between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda. Saddam Hussein and the Ba'ath Party were not involved in September 11th, but unfortunately there was a relationship between the two, continuing with Jacquard's text. "According to the same sources, there was another scenario more in keeping with the calculating mentality of Saddam Hussein and his secret services. In 1998, after declining all offers that had been made to them through official diplomatic channels, those services are reported to have established a secret operational connection, unquote, with Bin Laden in Manila and in Kashmir. It was indeed difficult for Iraq to ignore an Arab like Osama bin Laden who, quote, so effectively humiliated the Americans, unquote. Colonel Khairallah al-Tikriti, brother of the head of Mukhabarat, the intelligence services, is reported to have been named case officer for the connection. The arrest of two Moroccan associates of bin Laden in Rabat on November 11, 1998, made it possible to establish the link with certainty. According to Western sources, the Iraqi services have sought to secure the assistance of bin Laden's networks in case Iraq were again to be attacked by the United States in order to carry out attacks against American targets in Arab countries," unquote. Well, again, Still continuing with the nature of this agreement. According to Arab sources, in anticipation of a foreseeable reversal of alliances in Kabul, bin Laden had been in discreet contact since September of 2000 with associates of Uday Hussein, another of Saddam's sons. The ground for agreement was the anti-Israeli and anti-American battle. Bin Laden and the Iraqis are said to have exchanged information about chemical and biological weapons, despite the opposition of some of the Baghdad leadership, including Tariq Aziz. What's not mentioned here is nuclear technology, and as we're about to see, there's a very disturbing possibility that information may have been exchanged about nuclear technology as well, because for all of the public rhetoric about weapons of mass destruction, the fact of the matter is that the U.S. did nothing substantive to secure the capabilities, the technical expertise, which was legion, that Saddam Hussein had about weapons of mass destruction, including and especially nuclear. Not that there was hard technology ready to go, you know, the mushroom cloud scenario of Condoleezza Rice propaganda, but in fact, there was abundant expertise, and that expertise, folks, has gone missing. And of some thousands of Iraqi weapons of mass destruction technical experts, only three are unaccounted for. Three out of thousands. And in light of the doomsday scenario between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda, that is most disturbing indeed. Much of the rest of this broadcast is going to be the reading of a very important article from the current issue of Mother Jones magazine. Now, the current issue, as this is being recorded on 9/18/05, is the September and October 2005 issue of Mother Jones. This article is called In the Garden of Armageddon by Kurt Peiser, and the illustrations are by Tomar Hanuka. So again, the article, In the Garden of Armageddon by Kurt Pitzer, P-I-T-Z-E-R, illustrations by Tomar Hanuka. The article basically is about the fact that not only were the technical experts who could have realized Saddam's programs for nuclear weapons as well as other WMDs not accounted for, in fact, there appears to have been an almost compulsively perverse tendency on the part of elements of the U.S. occupation force not to secure these particular individuals. Much of the account of Kurt Pritz's article comes from the information provided by Mahdi Obeidi, one of Saddam's most important nuclear scientists. His name, capital M-A-H-D-I, last name, capital O-B-E-I-D-I. Obeidi was the fellow who had much of the blueprints and prototype pieces for building centrifuges buried in his backyard. There was some publicity about that, as we're going to see, however. Though the mixture of incompetence and perhaps at a deeper level deliberate subversion by elements of the underground Reich Fifth Column to which I've alluded, there was no substantive effort to secure the experts who could have provided, who could have realized the plans for weapons of mass destruction. And as has been publicized, tremendous amounts of hardware have gone missing, including great amounts of explosives of a very high grade, which could conceivably be used to detonate a nuclear weapon, and certainly would have tremendous applicability for some of the improvised explosive devices that have been haunting American combat forces there. And I want to note, too, that once Mr. Obeidi surrendered, or basically was taken into custody by U.S. troops in order to give some PR spin to what a great job we had done finding Saddam's weapons of mass destruction, there were televised displays of the material that had been buried in Obeidi's backyard. And as former UN weapons inspector David Albright pointed out, simply the televising, the images broadcast of that equipment and those blueprints would have been tremendously useful to anybody who wanted to build weapons of mass destruction. And again, I suspect that not only in this situation, but increasingly in the United States, in the year of our Lord 2005, what we're seeing is a mixture of conspiratorial process and utter incompetence. One should never underestimate the interplay between those two dynamics in the shaping of modern history. We're going to proceed now into this particular article again. In the Garden of Armageddon by Kurt Pitzer in Mother Jones issue of September and October of 2005. I met the mastermind of Saddam Hussein's former nuclear centrifuge program outside the Palestine Hotel in Baghdad a few days after U.S. troops took over the city in 2003. Despite the midday heat, he was dressed in a sport coat and tie, which made him look incongruous amid a scruffy crowd of protesters gathered to shout slogans at the U.S. Marines guarding the hotel. He said his name was Dr. Mahdi Obeidi, and he showed me a printout of a pre-war Washington Post story in which he was named as one of the Iraqi weapons scientists whom the U.S. government had very much wanted to interview. His eyes darted nervously back and forth between the protesters and the tense-looking Marines inside the cordon of concertina wire. Minutes earlier, he had approached a photographer friend of mine on the street saying he wanted to reach out to Washington with some important information about Saddam's nuclear program. It was a desperate move. He had tried contacting U.S. troops, but they'd rebuffed him and threatened him with arrest if he showed up again. Now, he wanted to know if he could use my satellite phone to help him. At first, I didn't know whether to believe him, but that night, at his urging, I dialed the Washington number of David Albright, a former American member of the United Nations Weapons Inspection Team, in Iraq. When I explained who had given me his name, the line went silent for a moment. "You're actually talking to Obeidi?" Albright finally asked. "Where is he? What did he say?" Unquote. We're going to continue with the reading of this article in the second half of the broadcast. I want to note that it is increasingly important for listeners to use the material that I've made available on the web. Those listeners who are only using or only listening to the broadcasts themselves are missing the better part of the for-the-record experience, so to speak. There's a tremendous amount of information available both in audio and in print on the web. First of all, sister station WFMU in Jersey City, New Jersey, is archiving the entire For the Record series on Real Audio and now also on MP3. The more recent shows are available at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery. Older shows at a longer URL link to both that website and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website as well. Spitfire, www.spitfirelist.com, the CD duplication service that stocks all of the work I've done over the years, has an enormous website with a vast and growing amount of printed information. First of all, in the For the Record section, there are written descriptions of each For the Record broadcast, generally archive or article-length written descriptions of the programs, often containing information I didn't have time to put in the original broadcast. At the top of each For the Record description, there are numerous links to other URLs that have, among other things, a search function, a page to click on for people to support the work that I'm doing, the Martin Bormann Nazi in Exile text in both HTML and PDF, a couple of lectures that I've done, a summary excerpting of the book Martin Bormann Nazi in Exile, a website put together by listeners in the Midwest featuring the article, the declassified U.S. government documents proving the Bush family's involvement with Nazi industry before, during, and after World War II, and again, links to the WFMU websites and to the WFMU podcasting website. So if you would like to have For the Record podcasted to you, just contact WFMU or just go to the top of each For the Record description and there it be. Okay, so please utilize the growing amount of information available on the Spitfire website and linked URLs. And please note that there's a page to click on to support the work that I'm doing. A generic thank you to those that have done that. Unfortunately, I do not have time to write thank you notes. It's all I can do to sustain the effort. That concludes the side one of For the Record Program 527, Death Trap Part 2, being recorded on September 18th of the year 2005. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.